give me your name?
Dorothy Jean Matthew Scott.
And where were you born?
Brandon, Manitoba.
And can you describe life on the prairies when you were young?
The happiest days of my life were spent from the time that I was a small child in Brandon, Manitoba, and we moved to a little town called Macaulay, Manitoba, originally named Rutherglen by the Scottish settlers. But after 44 Irish families proliferated at a very fast pace, the CPR came through and renamed the place Macaulay. We moved from Macaulay when I was 15 to Rokenville, Saskatchewan, which was an entirely different milieu, in that Macaulay was an integrated community with everyone enjoying life together, and Rokenville had about five strata, definite cliques, and you knew which one you belonged to.
Where were you in the strata?
We were near the bottom, and that's why Frank Scott, whose father was a partner in the biggest store, and I didn't get married till 50 years later. We'd just been married 2 years, but we were sweethearts when we were, from the time I was 16 till we were 20.
Did you live on the prairies during the Depression?
Yes.
Can you describe the Depression on the prairies and a bit of your family's experience?
My family's depression began 10 years before anyone else's, in 1922, when my father, who had bought a general store in Macaulay, had the business foreclosed. And so our depression, and my mother became ill with fibroid tumors of the uterus, which meant she wasn't really sick in the ordinary sense, but she was bedridden and I had to take care of her. By the time the real depression came on, we were in desperate, terrible straits. My father had graduated downward from the store that he owned in Macaulay to a small grocery store, to a tiny grocery store, to the final move in Rokenville when he was just a clerk for a man in Rokenville who was dreadful. Every month, my dad had a fight to eke a few dollars out of him, and there were five in our family, and my mother was ill. So I found life pretty rough and couldn't even complete my grade 11 because my mother said, "You can't go to school." Dawn, my brother 4 years younger, and Pat 6 years younger, and Betty 8 years younger, have to go to school, and of course mother was in bed. I find this a little difficult to talk to you about I, but mm-hmm. I guess that's what you want me to talk about it from my viewpoint. Well, I had no skills, although I'm musical by nature, so I went to Winnipeg and was enrolled as a student nurse in the Victoria Hospital. But the very day I got my cap, my dad phoned and said, "Mother is worse than ever. You have to come home." And I went home and nursed my mother, who had a recovery several months after that. So I'll skip the part where I got married, mm-hmm. and separated from my very traumatic experience. And looked for work as a housemaid.
As a domestic?
Right.
And when was that, and where was that?
My first job as a domestic was for a woman in Belcarra, Saskatchewan, who was the meanest woman I've ever worked for. She was the Anglican minister's wife, and she wanted to make me feel subservient, and finally I did something I never thought I'd have the nerve to do. I was making only $7.50 a month to house clean. That means washing down all the walls and floors and doing all the meals and everything else, and she treated me like a real slavey, mm-hmm. and I walked away from that job with nowhere to go and nothing, even without getting paid, because I couldn't bear to have my psyche so damaged.
Were a lot of women at that time domestic workers? Is that what young girls did when they were looking for work?
If you were lucky, your parents sent you to normal school. You became either a teacher or a nurse. And as a nurse, you got no pay in the little hospital I was in for the first 3 months anyway. And then you got $2.50 a month for the first year. By the time you graduated, you got $12.50. In the general hospitals, it was better than that. But I didn't have grade 12 and had to go to a smaller hospital.
So were you at first unable to find work as a nurse? Is that why you became a domestic?
Oh, yes. And anyway, I wasn't a qualified nurse. Mm-hmm. I didn't have an RN. And I went from that job after a day or two. I found work with another woman who also wanted her house cleaned and wanted me to take care of the house and two young teenagers while she went east. And as soon as she came back, she said to me, okay, you can go. And I had nowhere to go. So I went to the doctor of the small hospital and said, you know, I have had some experience nursing, practical nursing with my mother and other people, as well as my little bit of training. And I felt like I'd really come up a notch because I earned $25 a month, and I had to be receptionist, cook, laundry woman, and runaround girl in the operating room. And I worked very, very hard and learned to despise the nurses because they wouldn't lift a finger to help me, and I ran my health down very badly. I knew I had to get out of that situation, and I answered an ad in the Regina Leader Post that offered $10 a month for just working in a house. It turned out I took that job in St. Eluda, Saskatchewan, and it turned out that the woman who was then just over 50, had been a complete cripple since she was 23. She had had 5 miscarriages as a young woman and apparently arthritis, complete arthritis, had crippled her into a position where she was, scissor-like. Mm-hmm. I had to clean her teeth and her nose and feed her every bit of food and also look after her evacuations. And I stayed with that job even though I was very unhappy at it because she was bitter. I thought that by singing to her and reading to her, I would make her life happier. It didn't turn out that way. She actually resented my talent and treated me so badly that I had to leave, and I went from that job. By the way, I went there on July the 1st or 2nd, and by Thanksgiving time I tried to quit, and they begged me to stay. Her daughter and her husband begged me to stay, even though he couldn't pay me. So in those days, the Saskatchewan government gave domestics $5 a month, and he promised me $2.50 more. I never got the $2.50, and it wasn't because he was dishonest, it was because he never had that $2.50. That was, I think, the hardest year of my life. The hired man got $7.50, which is another example of the attitudes of governments and the general populace to the fact that although I worked harder than the hired man, he got more money than I did.
Was the $5 a month for domestics parallel to relief? Like it was as though the government was giving a subsidy to people to work rather than give them relief money. Is that what was happening?
It must have been because the local MLA, whose nickname was Beef, actually it was Mr. Dundas, and he looked like a chunk of beef, a very vulgar, illiterate man. His wife, although he didn't, you were supposed to have this hired girl if you owned enough land to call it a farm, and she was a farm help.
Right.
He got his wife a domestic. And I remember one little controversy where the mechanic in his garage said, my wife's having another baby and I want a hired girl. And he said, you can't have it. And he said, I want to have the paper to say I have a hired girl by 5 o'clock tonight, or you'll know why, because I'll complain to the government about all this fraud, because other people with a little pull around mm-hmm. town were also getting a girl on the basis of the fact that they were supposed to be farming.
Free labor.
He got it. The mechanic got the hired girl for his girl. So it was really on the basis of really...
What year was this?
I'm talking about 1935, 36, okay. 37.
And did the women who worked as domestics associate with each other at all?
It's hard for me to answer that, because although I was a domestic, there weren't very many in that small town, I was, if you'll pardon my saying so, a cut above the usual because of my community work. I always either sang or led a choir, and was interested in local politics, mm-hmm. things like that. So there was no organization of domestics whatsoever.
No. Okay. No.
I went from that job to a little better job in the town proper and got $6 a month.
What were you then doing?
Oh, housework.
Right.
Yeah.
What kind of tasks did you do for housework? You described the one nursing job, but was it like, it was heavy work, eh?
It sure was, and there were no amenities.
Right.
You know, I could pump pails of water and carry two pails of water, and if I wanted, swing one pail around without a drop spilling, you know, in a complete circle. In the winter of 35, 36, where times were very hard, we had no pork fat for pies, and I made pastry out of beef fat, and you should try that when it's cold. The yeast was the hard cake yeast, and you started it the night before and hung the old honey pail on a little stick so that it was in the reservoir where the water kept
right.
the yeast, but the yeast froze during the night.
Oh, wow.
In another place, my friend married a French man over by Lazare, and the old French lady knew how to keep one piece of yeast dough from the first baking that she had, and rolled it in all the old winter coats and unused quilts, and had it inside a trunk upstairs where it kept warm.
Like sourdough bread.
Right.
Starter, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
You emptied all slops. When I bring lettuce from the garden now and can wash it under a tap, and people talk about, isn't it great to have a dishwasher and all that, I think, my gosh, isn't it wonderful just to have water come out of a tap? When you have walked for a block or two and pumped it and then had to use it sparingly because you have to wash things two or three times, I will never accept all these amenities of life. And you try to make butter on a hot prairie summer day where you have to wash the little bits of fat that coagulate to make the butter, and it won't come, in quotes, come. It's heartbreaking. You just have no idea, and the heat can be so oppressive, and the bugs, you know, outside, and cleaning lamp shades and all the other things. My mother told me in the summer of 1934 that she thinks she got all of $1.89 in cash to send to Eaton's for a pair of what was called balbriggan underpants and a cotton shirt, a vest. That's all the cash that she had. It was a major tragedy to get a hole in your silk stockings. There was no nylon then, because you didn't know when you could replace them.
Right. So you did much of the work, you did the work that women in the family would do, except that you were paid to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Did the women, like on the farms or in the houses you worked in, did the women share the tasks, or did you work so that the lady of the household would not have to work?
In the situation I went to after this farm, $5 a month, I was replacing the lady of the house who had high blood pressure, and the doctor mm-hmm. said, don't work anymore. So always I worked where the whole load was on me.
It was on me.
I didn't tell you about while I had gone back to this man I was married to in 1932, trying to make the marriage work, mostly because of my Christian upbringing and thought I had to do this. We worked in Glenborough, where he was the baker and I was to be a help in the kitchen and bedroom or whatever, and serve in the restaurant that adjoined the bakery. I didn't get anything. He got $25 a month and I didn't get anything, and the conditions under which we worked were really terrible. The heat was so intense in this tin-covered building that to go upstairs and just put your hand, where I'd try to have a rest in the afternoon, to just put your hand on the bedstead, which is metal, would even burn you. And the men there, the owner and his son, and the man I was married to, all required white clothing because they were working in a restaurant and bakery. I used to iron 17 shirts, and that meant keeping a fire going in a hot prairie kitchen. And that's the year that the grasshoppers were so bad that the only jobs any of the men had in town, and they all wanted those jobs, was to spread sawdust that was impregnated with poison to kill the grasshoppers. And speaking of grasshoppers, in 1937, I saw fields planted where not a blade of grass came up. That year, in that little town, there was what they called Memorial Day Sunday, where they usually, it was in August, I'm not talking about November 11th, they always had a march to the cemetery and placed flowers on the graves or in remembrance of men who died in the First World War. There wasn't one flower blooming in that town, and they had to send to Regina for a wreath. I was to sing in Flanders Fields, which I nearly always sang, and I got up to sing, and the dress that I had a strip of organdy around the hem, probably to lengthen it. You either lengthened or shortened according to styles, and right. That's all you could do. And I felt something biting my leg just above the knee, and I looked down, and there was a grasshopper at least 4 inches long, the biggest one I think I've ever seen. But the pianist had already begun the introduction, and I didn't want the audience to notice, so I very slowly reached down and very, very unnoticeably clutched this part till he cracked and let him drop on the platform.
Oh, did the sort of arrangement where the husband would get paid for the labor of both the wife and the husband, was that common?
Oh, yes.
So that would mean that women were totally dependent on their husband's
mm-hmm.
goodwill in terms of giving
You bet. And you see, I finally left this man after trying to live with him five times at different intervals. And one of the threats that he always held over me, was, I've got a job and you've got nothing.
Right. How did you come to British Columbia?
I moved, and this is my first trade union life. I moved from having lived in Calgary from 1939 to 1946 and in Brooks, Alberta for a year to Calgary in November of 1946, and determined that I was going to find work in a sort of atmosphere that I enjoyed. By this time I had worked out of housework by going first to night school, and that's another story, because at one point I couldn't even afford $3 a month for night school. But I finally...
Why did you decide to go to night school?
Oh, because I had to get out of being a domestic. I just couldn't take it any longer. And the reason that I got out of night school and was able to work half a day at housework and half a day at school was that the war happened, and my brother became a pilot and was generous in sending my parents a very nice allowance, and Mother loaned me $15 a month to go to the Garbutt Business College in Calgary. And I eventually kept going back to school periodically till I got secretarial status. And I came out here, I met Eileen Suffren, who was then Eileen Tallman.
Right.
And among other things, I met other people too, but I told her that I was, this job was very poor paying. Retail Wholesale Union was just given the okay by steel workers. They were subsidizing, steel workers subsidized Retail Wholesale and the Packing House Union, and they were each willing to pay $50 a month. And so, ignoring some better jobs, I took that one.
Okay, just to roll back a little bit, how did you develop, a consciousness that would make you interested in working with the trade union movement?
Sarah, I think I'm being very glib about a lot of this because you're easy to talk to, so I would like to be as concrete as I can.
Yeah.
My grandfather, Major Arthur Charles Spencer Wells, came from England in 1882 and helped form the Conservative Party in Manitoba, so that my mother was always politically conscious. And my father, perhaps partly through the cruel experience of this foreclosure, which was, I won't go into that, although I had nightmares up until a few years ago, about walking into a store of my dad's, and if I dared turn my eyes, just turn my eyes, the minute I would look back, everything would be gone.
Like all your security swept away.
I guess so. Yeah. And I think both parents then, through experience and background, joined the CCF, or rather were sympathetic to it even before it formed. So I was listening to that all the time, and had a rebellious instinct, which I still have. As you know, I was one of the founders of the Memorial Society of BC and went across Canada 3 times to help form the National Association of Memorial Societies, a beautiful rebellion against undertakers.
Mm-hmm.
So when Eileen accepted me for that job, I was really very, very happy to get involved.
You'd been active in the CCF up till then?
Not very, because in Calgary, I think my mother and dad and I were the only people that voted CCF in the whole Bow Valley constituency. But
might
we voted CCF.
Yeah,
but we did and spoke about it openly and went to a few public meetings that were held down there in Calgary East in the Labor Temple it was then. Yeah. But that was the limit of my... But believe me, I was so so deeply hurt by the way I was treated as a domestic, because I never felt that I was any less a human being. And this is what was harder for me than the actual work I did, was to be treated the way I was treated.
Had you up to that point made any connections between those experiences as a domestic and yourself as a woman, in terms of thinking, questioning, for example, that your husband would get paid and you not paid, or that you would receive a certain wage and men who worked doing less work in similar kinds of situations?
I can't think that I did anything till I got to Vancouver.
Okay.
Not anything concrete. Talked about it lots, but...
So you got to Vancouver in
1946,
mm-hmm. And you...
And I started working in December the 10th, 46, for the unorganized Retail Wholesale Union and the Packing House Workers Union that was just getting a foothold in Vancouver and New Westminster.
And what kind of work did you do for
them? I was really just office work, although I went out and delivered leaflets. I was very anxious to do that. And joined the then Office and Professional Workers Organizing Committee, and negotiated with the IWA offices, and I became secretary to both the Vancouver Labour Council and the BC Federation of Labour, because the BC Fed had just come through this traumatic experience of attempt by the Communist Party of Canada to take it over in the summer of 1948. And they called the White Bloc won by one vote in both the Labour Council and the BC Fed. But the BC Fed had no money because the IWA funds were frozen mm-hmm. by the banks. And they had they asked me if I would do the work of sort of two secretaries at one pay, and being me, I said, proud to do so.
Okay, let me see. To start going through. So you had primarily an office job for retail wholesale,
mm-hmm.
but you also delivered leaflets. Was that to places that were being organized?
Right.
Where were they organizing?
The biggest one was BC Sugar, which was quite an exciting campaign. The Canadian Labour Congress did have a contract with BC Sugar, but agreed to allow retail wholesale to take that if they could win the employees over. And I went down there and delivered leaflets. I also delivered them the first strike that I remember the packing house workers having at Catelli Products. And the meat places, Fletcher's and Gainer's. And retail wholesale organized Mac and Mac, which was very difficult. And Marshall Wells. Those were their early conquests.
Were those places where both men and women worked?
Yes.
Okay. Were you familiar at all with some of the contract demands? And
oh, yes.
Okay, so yeah. What kinds of struggles was retail wholesale involved in terms of establishing working conditions? And
They got very good contracts, except I used to get sick and tired of sitting in Vancouver Labour Council Committee and hearing over and over again, we got 10 cents for the men and a nickel for the women. And that was the usual, not the unusual.
Did men and women do different work?
No. In part they did, but there were areas. There was a really good woman there in one of the meat packing plants. I think it was Gainer's, May Harvey. She was a spinster, and as far as I know, she still is alive, a very fine woman.
So there was no consciousness of equal pay within the union at all for men and women?
No. It was taken for granted that they would bargain for, quote, 10 cents for the men and a nickel for the women.
Did people talk about a justification for that ever? Was there ever a discussion of that?
If it came up at all, and it did come up, this old argument was, but if they both pack bacon, he has to push that tray away because she can't, Factory Act says that she can't lift more than 55 pounds or something like that. Yeah, even though you'd carted a baby around moved the washing, a load of heavy, wet clothes and things like that at home.
Did you ever hear the argument that the man had a family to support and the woman
didn't? Oh, heavens, yes. Sure did. Mm-hmm. I was going to show you a leaflet I came across the other day saying that, this is 1951, that I was going to one of the speakers at what they called town meeting in Canada, and should married women work? And of course, I was married but single or divorced and had a child, and there I was having to argue that it was all right to go to work. I don't know what they expected me to do.
Who are you arguing against?
The other lady on the program was a very fine person who was a prominent in the Roman Catholic congregation mm-hmm. in Vancouver, and her argument was that it was better, much better for the family and the community for a mother to stay home.
Did she propose how women would support themselves if they stayed home?
Of course, you didn't get divorced. You took whatever your husband would give you.
Okay. So you were working for retail wholesale, and also the packing house union,
yeah.
Was that the same union? Were they connected with each other?
No. Packing house is now the Food and Allied Silent Workers Union. Freddie Dowling organized those people right across Canada and held their first big strike in 1947, and they were getting 74 cents an hour. And they went on strike.
Okay, so they were working with fruit and vegetables primarily? Or?
No, meats primarily. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what places were organized while you worked for them in Vancouver or BC?
Well, as I said, there were the... you're talking about Packing House now.
Yeah.
Fletcher's and Gaynor's Meats and Jack Diamond, you know, and folks who owned stables of horses, not just one horse, were people that they had to bargain with. There were the jam factories. I shouldn't say no fruits. There were some. But when it came to the cold storage fruits, that was retail wholesale because, you see, those were warehouses as opposed to preserving fruits. So they had, and Buckerfields, which soon became a monopoly, things like that. And the hide, the men hated to be out of work and sent down to this hide-shaking place under Granville Bridge. I've forgotten the name of it. But mainly meats and fruits and jams.
Was that mostly men?
Yes. Right. Yes.
And how did their contracts compare with the retail wholesale contracts that were men and women?
They were good. They were really comparative.
Yeah. And did you do any actual organizing at all?
No? I wanted to. I tried to.
Oh, yeah? Can you describe that a bit?
Oh, yes. I would like to have been an organizer, but the jobs usually went to men. That's why it was so unusual to find Eileen. Who then was Anne, somebody in the tailoring trades. I've forgotten her last name.
Anne Marshall.
Yeah. I think that was...
For the ILGW.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you've met her, you know that the needle trades were an abominable organization, or rather, trade to try to deal with. They were dreadful. No, I did very little actual organizing, although I did try to get office workers, and that was really tough.
Can you talk about that? That's something that's very relevant right now.
Yeah, it was just... practically hopeless. Eileen was... I only worked with Eileen from December to April because she left April 47, you know, to try to organize Eaton's in Toronto. And we would do what we could, a little bit of leafleting, and but it was pretty well hopeless. And really, the only places organized then were the BC Co-op Wholesale and the credit union movement hadn't even got off on its feet then. So mainly the offices that we had in the what we call the off-walks were just trade union offices. And believe me, it wasn't very pleasant negotiating with some trade union people.
How was it organizing in the trade unions? Was that difficult to get the women?
Yeah, it was just, I think, just as difficult. It was grudgingly acknowledged that their employees, the women, had a right to be organized. As a matter of fact, here I am, over 65. I left the IWA after having quite a varied experience in the trade union, 25 years, and I have no pension. But I sat in the woodworkers' regional executive board many times taking notes and hearing them argue over how their pensions would be. And only once did I hear Kelly of New Westminster say, "Don't you think that we should talk a little bit about the female employees of this union?" And nothing more was said, and they never got a pension.
Let me...
On the gravy train, do you think you're going to get the same wages as the guy on the green chain? Now, the green chain was the lowest one in the union contract. And yet, here were we, most of us, with many years' experience and skills, and expected to do every kind of office work there was, and to be threatened with this, you think you're going to get as much as the guy on the green chain.
Right. So how did organizations start of women who were working for the unions? Who did that organize?
Oh, Eileen was responsible for saying in her own inimitable manner, you know, you fellows, you've got to set a good example. And she could embarrass people into going along with that.
So did that happen through the Labor Council, or did...
Yes.
Okay, and they all sort of...
It started with steelworkers, and because the steelworkers, you know, being established, had enough prestige and money behind them that they could, first of all, give their employees not only a good wage, but fringe benefits. Like, from the beginning, I think they had a pension plan, which they paid for entirely.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so Steel organized their own offices, and then it spread. Mm-hmm. Was that through women going around to various trade union offices and signing people up, mm-hmm. or...?
Well,
through the Labor Council?
Not too much women going around and doing it. The men did it because it looked like it was all right to do. They didn't do it because they wanted or because they offered it on a silver platter, believe me.
Yeah. So they would, so the men who were the staff people for the union would say, okay, the women who work there here have to be organized, mm-hmm. and would sign them up.
Yeah. And Charlie Millard was willing to say, my secretary, who is worth her weight in gold, mm-hmm. Margaret Lazarus, is worth every cent of this.
Yeah.
I couldn't get along without her. But pardon me if I sound a little bit cynical. Most of the people that I knew, the males on staff, did this to make themselves feel good rather than do something that was of real and definite benefit and to create a feeling that we were persons who deserved equal recognition.
So that would affect the kind of contracts they'd be willing to offer.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And were you on the negotiating team?
Yes. I was president of Local 15, not once, but two or three times. But then that was really because very few people were interested. Even the women in the trade union offices, you know, they were there because they wanted a pretty good salary and felt that they had some recognition in other areas, but union meetings were not well attended,
mm-hmm.
only around negotiating time. I used to feel disappointed, and as for political action, bleh.
Okay, just to get back to the negotiating part, what unions did you negotiate with?
Mostly IWA locals, and the packing house did, and retail wholesale offered a contract from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, you know that we didn't amalgamate. When I say we, I mean the entire trade unions didn't amalgamate till 1956.
Right.
So I didn't know much about the craft unions. However, when we did amalgamate, I found that there were some real good wage structures in the carpenters and plumbers, and in the Mr. Gerben was then secretary treasurer and became the first secretary treasurer of the Amalgamated Labor Council, and his secretary was well paid.
Okay, what kind of things would you negotiate for the contracts? What would be, you know, key contract demands?
Well, of course, wages and seniority were the main things, and grievance procedure. It was great to have grievance procedure, although the IWA in particular had one man who could find a way to fire people. And of course, trade unions weren't any different. After all, just like we say women are human beings, trade union personnel, males, weren't any different than other people in that they were could be as subtle or kind or cruel as any other person.
Management.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So there was no sort of higher level of consciousness within the trade union officers?
I can't be unkind and say there wasn't any higher level. I met people I still admire and think of very kindly. Dan Radford, who died a year ago, January, was a remarkable man. I knew Joe Morris from the time of the IWA split and was his secretary before he became the president of the Congress, and Jack Moore, who I thought was a genuine trade unionist, and many, many other people who I felt were, in quotes, real trade unionists. But there are an awful lot of phonies, just as you would find them in any other area of life. However, I don't want to leave the impression that I'm being cynical, because I get so heartwarmed when I see something like Barbara Frum's program on Sunday night about labor rights. I am disappointed that trade unionists are also workers who think they were born only to work. Mm-hmm. That's been my main grievance, and I've said it for 25 years. I said, why do you think you were born only to work? Because there is such a great need for them to take a greater role in the community and do more for the working class.
Right, okay. Was there a resistance to grievance procedure within the unions you negotiated with?
Oh, yes. We didn't win them.
Okay. What kind of things would they say against?
Mainly, the what I'm thinking of right now is secretarial help who became involved emotionally with one side or another, and would be the first grievance I ever had to handle was in Port Alberni, where they said a file went missing that was important to one side, and it was true, the woman in question had taken sides and so had either destroyed or taken out of the file something that was very important, and which they fired her. We didn't win that grievance.
Was that like sides inside the labor movement?
Yeah.
Was that in terms of the political debates going on?
Right.
So the union would be in a position then where it would, must have been really quite difficult in terms of having to defend a group of workers who at the same time would be affected by the general political.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah,
and defending everyone within that.
And of course, the reason I was hired by George Holm, who had won the secretaryship of the BC Federation of Labor in 48, and Jim Bury, who had just won the secretaryship of the Vancouver Labor Council, the reason was they knew I was part of that bloc.
Yeah, so, and yet you were in a position whereas...
I took the job of a girl who'd been fired.
Yeah.
By Harold, on Harold Pritchett's side, and he was the... then leader of the Communist Party in BC.
Sure.
I felt rather queer about that.
And then would there be women who were still Communist Party members or sympathizers who were still working within?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And they were in our union, the Office and Professional
right.
Women's Union, and we had some pretty sensitive experiences over that.
Would you be able to describe some of them? You don't necessarily have to give names of people, just to give a sense of the
conflict. Well, they ran for executive positions in the OTEU and against the group that I belong to, and we had to defeat them if we wanted to keep the union under our control.
Right.
Went on year after year after year. Might still be going on as far as I know, because when I left working for the IWA, there was still that situation where... women who worked for the Fishermen's Union and the Boilermakers Union and the still, quote, red bloc unions were opposed to, on the slate, were opposing persons from the so-called white bloc.
Right. And how would that kind of division affect the ability of the union to act effectively to defend all its members? Would that be a problem at all in terms of grievances and...
Say that again.
Well, did the political divisions inside the union affect its effectiveness as, you know, I guess an organization that could defend everybody?
I think that, now you're talking broadly, and I do think that it was rather sad that the Fishermen's Union was kept out of the CLC for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it hurt them. Unions closed ranks when there was... threat of the complete breakdown, although I watched that mine, mill, and smelter workers, steel workers fight in Trail with horror.
It's very terrible. Let me just turn this over.